For Christmas this year, I asked the kids if they would each get me a board game or a card game that we could play together that would be something that we could do, and they obliged me. The girls each got me a game. Zoe got me a souped-up version of Uno. It's like Uno on steroids. In addition to the skips and the draw twos, there's like six other pain cards that you can play, and it's been a lot of fun to play as a family. Eva got me Rummikub, which was a game I grew up playing with my grandparents, and so we've been teaching them that game. But I actually got Calvin a game that I grew up playing called Stratego. And if you're familiar with Stratego, it's like, thank you, it's a cross between chess and checkers and capture the flag. It's like all mashed into one. It's a strategy game, and you each start with exactly the same number of pieces with exactly the same strengths. Now, this is part of a long-term plan that I have. From here, we will progress to Risk. But the ultimate goal is to introduce him to the game that was my obsession growing up, which was Axis and Allies. Thank you. Yes, got some friends in the house today. Axis and Allies was introduced to me at a missions conference in 1995. I was a missionary kid, and a couple of the guys that came from across Europe had this tradition of playing this game at every conference, and they busted it out, and I was a World War II buff at the time, and I was like, there's a board game that reenacts World War II? I must sit here. And I sat there and watched them play for hours, because it takes hours to play. And the gist of the game is there's five players, and there's a team of three, the Allies, the United States, England, and Russia, and a team of two, Japan and Germany. And you do not start on even footing. The Axis have certain advantages at the outset. They've got more troops and planes and so on and so forth, but the Allies have geography and money on their side. And so if the Axis don't have everything break right for them in the first couple of rounds, it's pretty much all over. It's interesting because most games that we play start evenly, start with the players on the same footing, and everyone's got the same chance of winning. And I actually went to some discussion boards this week just to see. There's whole websites devoted to Axis and Allies. It is absolutely a cult, and that's okay. And everyone's talking about, man, does anyone know how to really win as the Axis? Like, what are the percentages? And the consensus is that the percentages say that it's really hard to win as the Axis unless those things break for you right away early in the game. When we think about our lives and society and what we're going to talk about today, economics and wealth and justice, we tend to operate subconsciously as though everyone starts out with the same number of chips in the game, as though everyone starts out roughly at the same starting point. And so that the only difference then is your own cleverness, cunning, strength, will, choices. We tend to operate that way subconsciously. We may know better, but we tend to operate as though the reverse is not true, because frankly, it's uncomfortable to think that we don't all start out on even footing. And so this morning, we're going to delve into the book of Proverbs and see what it has to say. We talked about wealth a bit last week. We're now going to look at those passages that overlap, talking about wealth and justice. Proverbs has a great deal to say on both of these topics. There's something like 150 total Proverbs out of the 500 that deal with one of those two topics. I'm only going to scratch the surface again this week, as I scratched it last week. We are going to look at about 20 different verses this morning, and I know that's going to come at you kind of rapid fire. I have supplied a complete list of all of the verses in the documents that are attached to the weekly email. If you didn't get that, didn't see that, would like me to send it to you directly, I'm happy to do that. Just let me know. You can fill out a comment card or email me. And if you'd like to come this Wednesday night, we're pausing our regular video curriculum that we've been going through, and we're just going to spend the whole hour diving into some of those other verses and digging deeper into this material, because it is vast. This is a topic that not only Proverbs, but Scripture as a whole says a great deal about. And so we want to dig into that as best we can. So the first thing that Proverbs tells us, or Proverbs offers when dealing with this topic of wealth, economics, and justice, is that it's clear-eyed about economic systems. Proverbs does not approach this topic with rose-colored glasses. It does not assume that everything is hunky-dory in our economic systems. Proverbs 22:7 says this, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. And you recall last week that we talked about not every proverb is telling us something we ought to do. Not every proverb is telling us that things are good or bad. Sometimes it's just an observation, and this is just an observation about the way the world works. The rich rule over the poor. It is never the reverse, if you've noticed. The poor never rule over the rich. Money always brings with it power, and power tends to bring with it money. It is rarely ever the other way around. And so this proverb is, again, a general statement of reality, the way that things are, without commenting on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And it hints at this idea of borrowing, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but this idea that borrowing creates relationships of enslavement between the lender and the borrower. One other thing to note here, and this is true throughout the book of Proverbs as well as the rest of Scripture, and I came to this realization a number of years ago. Scripture is not aware of the existence of what we would call the middle class. There are only two groups of people in the mind of Scripture, because really in the ancient world there were only two basic groups of people, the rich and the poor. Now, that's part of why applying these verses and exploring this can be difficult and challenging for us, because very few of us, I'm told, think of ourselves as either rich or poor. Something like 95% of Americans identify as middle class. That kind of defies the average, right? That it can't possibly be true that everyone is above average, everyone is average, that's why averages exist. But we identify as middle class. We don't want to think of ourselves as rich. We don't want to think of ourselves as poor. The reason for that is what I believe Scripture is identifying and the ancient world knew to be true. The rich have security. It's not simply about the amount of money that you have. It's what the money brings with it, which is the freedom from having to worry about tomorrow. The poor do not know where their next meal is going to come from. They are reliant on their daily wages from an employer. Their economic existence is usually in the hands of someone else over whom they have very little influence and power. And so if we think of it in those terms, it's a little more helpful. And what I came to realize is that at no point in my life could I really and truly say that I was in the condition that the people identified as poor in Scripture found themselves in. And if there's only two options, that means that I'm in the other category. That biblically speaking, while I might not identify as rich, that when I read Scripture and it's speaking of the rich and the poor, I need to read what it says about the rich as though it's saying it about me, because I'm not worried about where my next meal is going to come from, or the one after that, or the one after that, or the one after that for a few weeks at least. I'm really not worried. I know that I have some stability and some security economically. And so that's important for us to recognize at the outset, or we won't be able to make sense of much of what follows. And so Scripture identifies these two categories and insists that there is not only an inequality of income, an inequality of possessions, but an inequality of power. It's not just that the rich have and the poor do not. The rich are able to rule over, to control the destinies and the lives of the poor. And so that it hints at this systemic factor. Proverbs 22:9, two verses later, says this: "Whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor." Now here we need to pause and reflect back on what we saw last week. Proverbs had a great deal to say about how someone becomes wealthy, the things that lead to wealth and the things that tend to lead towards poverty. And so we looked at things like wisdom and foolishness. Wisdom leading to wealth, foolishness leading to poverty. We looked at righteousness and wickedness. We looked at diligence and the sluggard, laziness. And the assumption could be then that, well, if someone finds themselves poor, it's because they have chosen to be foolish or lazy or wicked. In which case, this verse makes no sense. If poverty is only the result of individual character traits and decisions, then what would be the virtue in being generous to the poor? And yet over and over again, Proverbs enjoins those who are rich to be generous to the poor, which in itself is an admission that poverty is not only the result of an individual's choices. We must acknowledge that and understand that, again, to make sense of anything that Proverbs has to say to us. Proverbs is clear that there are individual choices that have economic outcomes, but it is also clear that the poor are not universally in the condition that they are in simply because of choices they've made or things that they've done. And so being generous to them is virtuous because it acknowledges that it's something beyond their control. So these are the two sort of anchor points that Proverbs names in being clear-eyed about the systems we find ourselves in. But Proverbs is not content simply to look at those general rules, because that would be very easy, right? There's rich and there's poor, and you ought to be kind to the poor, and we can pray and go home, and that would be the end of it. Proverbs has a great deal more to say, because wisdom insists on naming systemic economic injustices. Wisdom gets specific. And here I need to make something very clear. By the way, we are not nearly as clever as sometimes it may appear. I didn't know Joel was going to be here sharing this morning, and that's why I chose to speak about wealth and social justice. I saw Joel in the foyer, and I was like, oh, that's right, you're here. What a, you know, coincidence, right? We don't believe in those around here. And so I don't do this on purpose, but I don't have Joel's level of specific training. No one's asking me to write books on social justice and the gospel, because I got a solid B in my economics class, the one that I took as part of my bachelor's degree. And that B was given by a professor who had such a ridiculous curve that the lowest grade anyone got in the class was a C. I actually scored a 45% on one of the midterms and got a B. So I'm gonna do my best to stay in my lane this morning, okay? I'm not an economist. That's my dad. If you want to know about high finance, that's my dad. My dad spent his life doing business and then doing business as mission. And so I've seen this up close, but if you want the particulars about financial matters and how the gospel intersects, talk to Joel, talk to my dad. Don't talk to me. I am going to stay in my lane, though, and it is because I'm convinced, as Joel is, that Scripture has a lot to say about this. And so my role is not to give specific prescriptions about how we ought to run the economy or what you ought to do with your money and your business and the economic decisions that you face. But it is to lay out what Scripture says in broad strokes about the posture that we should have towards wealth and economic systems and injustice. And particularly as we look at the book of Proverbs, and I'll remind us of this verse that comes in the purpose statement of the book, Proverbs 1:3, that wisdom, if we're gonna be wisdom, be people of wisdom, be wise, it's not just a matter of a spiritual attitude towards God and a sort of moral righteousness. It is to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity. Those things have a bearing on our social systems. Justice and equity are things that happen in the public square, in our courts, in our legal system, in our marketplaces, in our businesses. And so wisdom absolutely has a bearing on this. And so we're gonna get into some of these specifics. The first, as I mentioned, the borrower is the slave to the lender. Proverbs has a very negative view of debt, borrowing, and lending. Proverbs 22, 26, and 27 says, "Be not one of those who give pledges, who put up security for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should your bed be taken from under you?" And this is essentially the person here who's putting up security. What's happened is two people have entered into an economic arrangement in which someone has incurred debt. They didn't borrow, they find themselves indebted, and this would likely be some sort of poor landowner whose crop hasn't come in and they owe their landlord and they can't pay the debt. And so someone else is sought as a third party to guarantee that person's debt so that they don't lose the farm. This third person is essentially functioning like a credit card company. They're going to guarantee the debt that you're going to incur with the merchant, the local mall, whatever it is. They're going to stand as the third party. And Proverbs says, don't do that. That's foolish, because now you're putting yourself on the line for someone else's financial decisions. There's not necessarily a moral component to this. It's just saying that's risky. Now, in our context, credit card companies protect themselves from that risk by charging interest for the money. I refer you now to Proverbs 28:8. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. Not only Proverbs, but the law of Moses and the prophets speak about charging interest for money in universally negative terms. And this is why I think sometimes we don't approach these passages or scripture on these matters. And again, trying to stay in my lane here, but the whole economic system we live in is based on the idea of charging interest, of charging money for money over time. Many of us are participating in that system. I am. I owe the bank money for my house, and they're charging me a pretty penny for that money that they lent me to buy my house so that I own it. We all know who really owns the house. And Proverbs says that's not terribly smart. And if the authors of these Proverbs were present in 2008, I think they would say, told ya. We saw what can happen when that system suddenly is shown to be what it is, which is a house of cards. C.S. Lewis made the point in Mere Christianity, and I remember reading this years ago and going, oh, I'm sure there's like nuance here. Not in scripture anyway. It may be that our system is justified, but we need to understand that this has a tendency to create poverty. It tends to enslave people. Just ask Dave Ramsey, and I agree with him on this, when it comes to debt and what debt tends to do. But it's not just that that creates a problem in the ancient world. Proverbs 20, verse 10 is one of several references in Proverbs to unfair scales. Unequal weights and unequal measures are both alike an abomination to Yahweh. Now, we don't have scales in our marketplaces, but when I lived in Romania, we did. You'd go to the outdoor market, and you'd buy your carrots or your potatoes, and the farmer that brought their crop in to sell that day would have a scale. And they'd have these weights, and they'd put the weights on one side, and they'd put the amount of carrots or potatoes or radishes or whatever you were buying on the other side, and once it all balanced out, they'd know how much you wanted to buy, and then they'd charge you the rate. The principle here is that the unscrupulous merchant has two sets of weights, one for the general public and one for very special friends of Rick's. And if you're a very special friend of Rick, then you put the smaller weights so that you're able to get away with paying less than you should. And everyone else gets taken for a ride. This is about favoritism. This is about treating some people in your economic dealings differently than others. And so Proverbs is very clear that we're not to allow that sort of favoritism in our system. Proverbs 22:16 echoes this and identifies who you might be paying favorites with. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. This verse lays out a principle, and there's a number of ways that we could think about it, but one of the ways in our global economy is where do we obtain the products that we buy? Who made them? Were they paid well? Or is their labor being exploited to increase the profit margins of large companies, and we're benefiting by paying less, and we don't want to ask too many questions about where our chocolate or our clothes or our technological devices come from, because we wouldn't like the answers. Again, complicated systems, and I'm not proposing there are simple solutions, but simply to say that Proverbs encourages us to have a posture that cares about these things. Proverbs 13:23 speaks about the denial of opportunity. When Proverbs talks about being generous, and we're going to have much to say about this over the course of the morning, the solution is not simply take funds from the rich and give them to the poor. Proverbs 13:23, the fallow ground of the poor would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice. And commentators are in disagreement about what specifically is in view here. It's possible that what's in view is the ground that is left fallow, that's not planted every seventh year in Israel's system that was set up by the law of Moses, is designed so that the poor can go in and glean, that they can work and be able to glean a harvest for themselves. So it's not a handout. It's not simply bundling the grain and handing it over to them. It's allowing them the opportunity to labor and receive what they need. It could also be simply that poor people may have fields that they work of their own, and they've tilled it and they've worked it, but the system is stacked against them in such a way that injustice takes away the fruits of their labor. Either could be in view, but what's being said is that denying the poor the opportunities they need in order to change their circumstances is one way of oppressing them. It's one way of perpetuating injustice. And this is one that we see in our own society. I've seen it in Milwaukee specifically, and I've had conversations with business owners here that one of the greatest barriers for the people in impoverished circumstances in our society to gaining jobs is if they have any sort of criminal background. And it doesn't have to be that they went on some sort of murder spree. It can be for fairly minor offenses, but many employers simply will not interview someone who has any sort of criminal background. That denies them the opportunity and perpetuates their condition. Again, I'm not suggesting they're simplistic solutions, but I know employers that have found ways to provide those opportunities while still safeguarding their businesses. Proverbs 17:23 speaks to one that's become prevalent in our day. The wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert the ways of justice. Earlier in this chapter, bribes are spoken of in a way that I think is really creative and kind of interesting. It says a magic stone. The one who gives a bribe, it's like a magic stone. Everywhere they go, they prosper. And again, that's just a statement of fact. Bribes work. When we moved to Romania, the entire system ran on bribes. And it wasn't always to do this, to pervert justice. Sometimes it was just to get people to do what they were supposed to do in the first place. Doctors were paid the same rate as everybody else in the communist system, so they were really incentivized to provide the highest quality care, so long as you gave them some gifts along the way to make sure you actually got the highest quality care. You're not bribing them to do something dishonest. You're just trying to get them to do what they're supposed to do in the first place. And that was across the board in every sector. They call it the bakshish. If you did not pass the bakshish, you didn't get anything done. You could not expect to get anything done. But it was also used to pervert justice. And the whole system was set up this way. And if you didn't have the money, you weren't going to get very far. We've seen it in the college admissions scandal. Something that we sort of all knew, that being rich made it better for you getting into colleges. We saw just how explicitly true that is. If you know the right person and can grease the right palms, you can secure for your kids a better educational future. We've seen it come out. So wisdom names all of these sorts of specific things that make us uncomfortable and squirm in our seats. And at this point, we say, well, surely that's what we need government for, to try to regulate and control some of this injustice. And Proverbs says, absolutely. And so wisdom guides rulers to pursue economic justice. The debate we have in our society about the proper role of government when it comes to economics, Proverbs indicates that government has a role here. And I'll ask you to turn to Proverbs 16, verses 10 through 15. This is one of the rare places where these proverbs are meant to be read as a unit, not as isolated statements. Proverbs 16:10, an oracle is on the lips of the king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. A just balance and scales are Yahweh's. All the weights in the bag are his work. Again, indicating economic justice when it comes to our economic dealings. It is an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness. Righteous lips are the delight of a king, and he loves him who speaks what is right. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring rain. Now, as in the literal sense, Democrats and Republicans. In other words, we live in a democratic republic. We read these verses about kings and sort of scoff as we enthusiastically follow the dealings of the royal family in England, from which we declared our independence and fought a bloody revolution to get away from. But we're fascinated by the inner workings of the royal family, it seems. And we look at this and we say, really? The king's mouth does not sin in judgment? We fought wars and had a Protestant Reformation, all to get rid of the idea of the divine right of special individuals who by their birth are perfect in their judgment. These verses are setting forth the ideal that kings, because of the power they hold, must seek righteousness for their people. This is the ideal. It is not meant to be a picture of reality. Proverbs knows all too well that there is such a thing as an unjust ruler. It's not suggesting that there isn't, but this is the ideal. Because of the power the king holds, they have a responsibility. And so there's a mandate that goes with this. There's a king, we don't know anything about him except that he had a mother named Lemuel. And Lemuel's mother, in Proverbs 31, gave him this mandate as a king. It's fascinating. Proverbs 31, verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted." Lemuel's mother is warning her son against embracing this idea that it's good to be king because of all the perks that come with the job. No, your job, Lemuel, is to decree righteousness, justice, and equity for the afflicted. And if you treat the life of a king as one that is wine, women, and song, you will neglect your responsibility. Now, this isn't just a screed against pleasure, because then she goes on to say, it's not for kings to drink. Verse 6, give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Psalm 104 says that wine is given by God to gladden the hearts of people. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. And so there is this activity of the king to comfort the poor as much as humanly possible, to buffer the pain that they feel because of their poverty. But it doesn't stop with those acts of compassion. Verses 8 and 9 say this: open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. The job of the king, who is both wealthy and powerful, he's at the top of the pyramid, is to pay keen attention to the rights of those at the bottom of the pyramid, not to further exploit them, and not to leverage his position to bring comfort to himself, but to bring comfort to those under his care. But we know that kings all too often don't do that. And that's why Proverbs is also clear-eyed where kings are concerned. And Proverbs 29, 26 says, many seek the face of a ruler. We look to government to fix it and are routinely disappointed. But it is from Yahweh that a man gets justice. The government cannot ultimately fix what we see around us. The king is not powerful enough to upset these systems, because they're deeply ingrained because of sin. They have a responsibility and should do what they can, but we should not look ultimately to the king, to the government, to a political solution, because Yahweh is the one from whom justice and righteousness come. And that is why ultimately, as much as we're talking about social justice and all of these economic realities, the Proverbs always, unique among ancient wisdom literature, point us to the heart of the God who is all wise. And so wisdom understands and seeks Yahweh's heart for the poor. This is far more about a posture, and that's my lane. My lane is to encourage our hearts to be postured appropriately towards God and towards our neighbors. Joel's and my dad's and others' lanes is to tell us what that might look like specifically. So I am doing my best to stay in my lane this morning. And Proverbs has a lot to say about the heart of God. I was struck this week by how many times we're not just told that it's wise to be good to the poor, that it's foolish to lean into your wealth and privilege and power, but how often it puts it in terms of Yahweh. Proverbs 17, 5, whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. This last, two Wednesdays ago, our curriculum asked us to think of all the words that we've heard used or that we've used to speak to people about people who are experiencing poverty, and there weren't very many positive ones on that list. How we think about, speak about, understand people can be mockery, even if it's not outright mockery. And we can become self-contented. We can look at them and use labels that allow us to feel good about our own accomplishments and justified in doing nothing to alleviate their affliction. It's mockery, and it's not just an affront to them, it's an affront to God. Proverbs 29, 13, the poor man and the oppressor meet together. Yahweh gives light to the eyes of both. It's interesting that it doesn't say the poor and the rich. The assumption is that it's the poor and the oppressor. They meet together. Yahweh gives light to the eyes of both. When you see someone in poverty, do you only see their poverty or do you see the light of God in their eyes? They are image bearers. Proverbs 14, 31, whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honors him. This set me back. Again, Proverbs often deals with contrasts. The contrast here is not what I expected. Failure to be generous is a form of oppression. The contrast here is between oppression and generosity, not generosity and stinginess. Stinginess is itself a form of oppression. The failure to respond compassionately is itself a form of oppression. Proverbs 23, 10 through 11, do not move an ancient landmark or enter the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you. Whatever security someone in poverty might have, are we doing things to protect that security, to build upon it, to strengthen the platform on which they stand, or are we doing things that further undermine that on which they depend, however little it might be? And here we think about things like affordable housing. We have encountered this more and more in the office the last 2 years. People coming desperate to try to maintain the housing situation that they have, and the system is against them. They've done nothing to where they deserve to lose their housing situation, and yet they find themselves on that razor's edge that you and I take for granted. And it's bigger than we can fix. Are we doing things to support and strengthen the security of those in poverty? Proverbs 22, 22, and 23. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate. That's in the legal context. The gate was the courthouse of the ancient world. For Yahweh will plead their cause and rob of life those who rob them. You should be getting the picture at this point that God is firmly on the side of the poor. It's interesting. There are no verses that I have found yet in Scripture, and I've read all of them at least once in my lifetime, that say that God pleads the cause of the rich and powerful. Not one. There's lots like this. I'm going to give you a homework assignment for the sake of time. Proverbs 11. This is one that we looked at last Wednesday. We'll look at it again this coming Wednesday. These verses speak about the impact of righteous people in a society. And the way that it speaks about it is not what we expect, at least it's not what I expect. And so I'm going to ask you to take that and consider those. But as we come to the now what are we to do with this? I hope I've given you some things to think about. But I mentioned a moment ago that there are no verses that I'm aware of in Scripture that speak of God blessing the fat and contented. In fact, Jesus, who is the wisdom of God, as we have been considering, says explicitly, blessed are the poor. Matthew's gospel records, blessed are the poor in spirit. We preach that one a lot. Luke gives us a parallel, blessed are the poor, full stop. And then contrasts it by saying, woe to you who are rich. So there's no getting around it. And we're uncomfortable. Really, God advocates for the poor, regardless of their spiritual condition? Jesus said it, and I have to believe it. Here is what Jesus is after, though. The blessing that comes to the poor is because the poor know their condition. The rich don't tend to know their condition. They feel contented. And so it allows them to do what Proverbs 21 says. 13 warns us against. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. That verse ought to cause us to do a gut check. Why is that? Why is it that God hears or does not hear me based on whether I hear the cry of the poor? The reason is this: God only hears the cry of people who know their poverty. And their poverty is not always material. All of us are poor spiritually, whether we are poor economically or not. But our economic prosperity can cause us to be blind to our true poverty. Really, what it means is that we don't cry out. And so we do not hear others when they cry out. We're now going to enter into a time where we're going to sing, And Can It Be? Our tendency is to be contented, and not in the biblical sense, to be contented in ourselves, and to miss the marvel that our God, who was rich, became poor, and that somehow benefits us. So we're going to begin, and then we're going to celebrate that we serve a God who does indeed hear us when we call.